before we go in, let me tell you a little about an English pub. It's not like a saloon. It's more like a club for men and women who haven't a great deal of money and who don't drink for the sake of drinking, but for the company. Now, these pubs are open for a couple of hours in the middle of the day and then again in the early evening. And men and women, after their day's work, and they work long and hard hours, come in for a bitter a mile. Oh, that's beer to you. So, well, come on, take a look.
Welcome to TWT-FM, a weekly podcast from the world transformed, bringing year-round radical political education and utopian thinking to bear on the issues that define our world. In our second series, we're exploring the concept of leisure, and in particular, aspects of life we've been missing due to the COVID crisis. What does leisure time reveal about our relationship to work and time under capitalism, and how our lives might be different with access to more of it? For now, though, turn up your headphones, sit back, and listen up. This is The World Transformed.
I will be going to the pub myself and cautiously but irreversibly raising a pint of beer to my lips.
There was something of a national frenzy when pubs partially reopened on April the 12th. After many months starved of social contact and communal boozing under lockdown, the British people were positively parched. Some drinkers were so keen to sink their first pint that they queued up long before pubs opened their doors at the stroke of midnight. Others waited until sunrise for a breakfast bevy, undeterred by inauspicious weather. But what exactly is it about these cosy wood-panelled institutions that inspires an almost fanatical level of devotion? Clearly it's not just about the alcohol. After all, home drinking is usually a cheaper and perhaps more convenient alternative. Rather, it's something to do with being around people and not just people you know. Pubs are an example of what American sociologist Ray Oldenburg calls the third place. A space other than the home or workplace where people interact and find solace from the loneliness and dislocation that characterises much of life under late capitalism. A space to recuperate after a hard day's work, where the nagging pressure to be profitable and productive temporarily abates. A space to celebrate and commiserate. A place just to be. But perhaps we should be a little bit more circumspect about the social value of pubs. Pubs can often be highly gendered spaces, encouraging obnoxious male behaviour. And having come to be so prominently associated with Britishness, pubs can perhaps feel exclusionary to individuals and communities who don't drink alcohol, or a venue for cringeworthy politicians to performatively convey their authenticity and macho leadership credentials. Despite this, pubs remain focal points for communities up and down the country, an expression of social ties that have been gradually eroded by decades of neoliberalism. A recent study suggested that rising support for far-right organisations is related to pub closures in economically deprived areas. As social spaces disappear, people become more atomised, more anxious, and more susceptible to scapegoating others for their social ills. In this episode of TWT-FM, we've ordered up three rounds of refreshing audio beverages to quench the minds of even the most parched listeners. We'll hear about the difficulties and opportunities for organising among bartenders, then take you on a pub crawl to remember across time and space. But first, we'll start with a sharpener, a brief history of the last 200 years of pub use from academic and organiser Callum Kant.
I think it's really interesting. If you look back at the history of the pub in capitalism, right, it's quite unevenly integrated. So if you look at, for instance, Engels writing about Manchester and the condition of the working class in England, Engels describes a kind of a network of public houses, beer houses, jerry shops, secret distilleries, and you have this kind of unregulated local sector, which is highly integrated with kind of local communities and not really dominated by capitalist production per se. It's a very informal, small-scale production of alcohol and informal small-scale creation of environments in which to serve that alcohol. Now, that's kind of what Engels is looking at in the 1840s. But then between kind of that point and the mid to late 19th century, you see a huge transition as breweries basically buy up these local institutions and transform them into what amounts to basically guaranteed sales outlets for their beers. So by 1913, you've got 95% of licensed properties owned by breweries, right? So the change here has been from small-scale production where, you know, you might be brewing a bit of beer or some spirits to serve to local customers to centrally controlled breweries which own these pubs in order to have a guaranteed place to sell their beer, right? And eventually you end up with just six brewers basically coming to dominate the market. So capitalism transforms over those kind of 60 years, a decentralized system of small-scale commodity production into a kind of monopolistic, centralized sector of mass production and consumption. So there's a number of different legal arrangements, a number of different ways in which you can set up the relationship between the brewer and the pub. But basically, a lot of the profit in the sector is being made in the brewery. So, you know, the labor required to brew, produce and distribute beer is where the money's being made. And the pubs operate as a way of making sure you've got somewhere to sell it. And then you know, the breweries kind of extract a rent from these places. So the actual pub itself isn't particularly thought of by capital as a workplace, right? The pub itself is a realization outlet. It's kind of more of a shop than it is a actual, you know, a service environment where labor has to be productive. That strategy kind of dominates throughout the period where the breweries are the big people in control of the whole industry. But then in 1989, you get these things called the beer orders. You get a division in model where the Competition Commission decides we want to split it into two. So we're going to split it up between alcohol producers and pub operators. And for the big brewers, they had to sell off basically a load of their pubs and choose, you know, do you want to be people who run service sector workplaces, pubs, or do you want to be people who produce commodities in the form of alcohol for sale? Now, what they decided to do almost universally was to go to the brewery model. They saw that as the more important side of their business, and the pubs were kind of an afterthought. So they just sold them all off, right? A lot of them went into kind of the control of the landlords who'd been running them or started to get consolidated. And this is where I think Wetherspoons come in. And Wetherspoons is really paradigmatic for thinking about how the modern pub situation emerges, because Spoons at this point expands colossally, right? They just buy up a load of these pubs that have been sold off by the breweries, and bit by bit they start to put together a huge chain that is kind of centrally managed in the style of a McDonald's, where they actually really think about the way that labor's applied in the pub in order to make it productive. So in terms of expansion, you're talking about they have two pubs in 1979 and 44 by 1992. They then float on the London Stock Exchange and raise £24 million, then go on to expand from there. So they're actually increased by over 1,000% in the decade between 1992 and 2002. So that's where you see kind of the huge explosion of the modern pub. It's after that forcible deconcentration where the brewers get kind of chucked out of the industry. Now, that really changes the way in which the pub environment works for workers. I think we're going to touch on this a bit later, but basically the pub worker used to not be under the same amount of pressure. They didn't have to be productive because the value is being produced elsewhere. What they had to do is make sure that that value was kind of realized. But now there's an expectation of a certain kind of service work in the pub that makes it really productive. So, you know, for a worker who compares the pre-Wetherspoons and post-Wetherspoons regime in a British pub, it's suddenly a lot more intensified. There's a lot more attention paid to making sure they're productive. You know, things like working in the kitchen is suddenly gone from kind of an afterthought where pub food is just, you know, not really that taken that seriously and turned into a McDonald's style kitchen. There's a whole load of transitions there that really change things. So from a worker's point of view, that's a massive transition. But also this is happening exactly the same time as there's a huge transition for the consumer. So if you think about pubs, historically, actually, one of the major phenomena that's happening at the same time as Wetherspoons is starting to expand is that there's a massive disenchantment with pubs. So young people are actually flocking away from them in huge numbers. I mean, if you talk between 1987 and 1992, pub attendances fall by 11%. And they don't fall kind of, you know, universally across the board. They fall with young people. Now, why is that the case? Because young people are experiencing a new kind of nighttime culture that actually allows them to kind of escape the bounded environment of the city centre pub that closes at 11, and they can experience going out and taking pills in the field. And that real change kind of disenchants a lot of people with what the pub was, which was seen not only as a positive place of working class identity, which it certainly could be in places, but also as a restrictive, patriarchal, limited place of recreation, right? It didn't fulfill people's aspirations, whereas rave culture and the emerging free party movement kind of offered people much more freedom and an opportunity to go outside of that limited model of recreation. So pub attendances are falling, and pubs really don't seem to be the future of like urban recreation at all, until you have a process that clamps down on rave and kind of forcibly reintegrates people into that pub environment. So here we're obviously talking about the 1994 Public Order Act. This is famously the act that like criminalises repetitive beats. But there's also a kind of a more general process whereby there's a liberalisation of the rules around drinking in city centres, and this kind of unholy alliance of local government, national government, the alcohol industry and pub owners decides that they want to reinvent city centre drinking. So here you have kind of the transition from rave culture to binge drinking as one that's actually brought about through things like changes in licensing laws, the invention of alcopops is kind of meant to stimulate the same kind of narcotic effect as pills, and an expansion of what's allowed in the city centre. So going and getting absolutely tanked up on a night out in a kind of a new bar-y place, drinking alcopops rather than ale, that's the kind of new identity. And this is when Spoons is doing that massive 1,000% expansion, right? So as rave is shut down forcibly, that's kind of the stick. There's also the carrot of you can have city centre drinking. You can have the pub as a new space of consumption, no longer kind of the old cosseted pub of the 1970s.
Right. We get the tube into Camden and head for the nearest bog-standard indie-oriented bar. We smoke a fatty boom batty on the way so that we can be absolutely munted by the time we order our first drink. We stay there for a few hours, where if all goes to plan, we'll end up laughing like a couple of twats. We then relocate to a low-level high street pub with an eclectic jukebox and keep drinking until we A, fall over, B, puke, or C, fall over and puke.
The pub has always been this environment that the state is very interested in. It's got to be the pressure valve for a lot of society, and it's got to be the place that you're allowed to let off steam after working. It's got to be hedonistic. It's got to be outside of the norms, in a sense. It's got to be a zone where things are allowed in society that aren't allowed elsewhere, kind of forms of behaviour and so on and so forth. And that's their attraction for us. But the state has to allow that, but it also doesn't want it to get out of hand, right? So one of the major changes when we're going from kind of Engels' Manchester to that 1913 situation where 95% owned by breweries is kind of, you know, a much more intensive licensing operation, a much more intensive attention by the state as to how drinking is organised and how it's permitted. And there's always been this balance struck between, you know, how far do you let people or let people who go to pubs enjoy themselves in the way they actually want to enjoy themselves, and how far do you restrict the activity there, be it through processes of licensing or looking for illegal behaviour or so on and so forth. I think this is really obvious in the recent discussion about shall we put cops into clubs. There's an immediate kickback by lots of people because pubs are kind of a zone where certain forms of illegal behaviour are just kind of allowed to happen. And the same with clubs, you know, particularly when you're talking around drug legislation, for instance. There's an expectation that in, you know, certain kinds, not every pub and club, but in certain kinds of pubs and clubs, that there will be basically no penalty for the use of illegal substances within that site. Now, certainly, there's a whole regime of criminalisation that targets the process of getting to that point. But the outrage was because the state seemed to be reaching into the night out experience in the way that the state previously hadn't. So it's always a very difficult balance, I think, for the repressive apparatus. How far do they actually try and control what's going on in these sites, and how far do they just permit things? If people can remember back, I mean, it is a while ago now, but the discussion around 24-hour drinking and changes in licensing laws under kind of New Labour, there was a lot of alarmism from certain parts of the British establishment who thought that this would be unleashing the hounds and really enabling a certain kind of profound deprivation. I think that constant tension between how much should we allow, how much should we intervene, is one of the defining tensions that really shapes the way that pubs operate as cultural spaces, certainly.
Blimey. So, this is a pub? Well, it was, and it will be again. Just imagine, me in the pub all day, but no one can say anything, because it's my job, so I've got to be there. I'll literally get paid to go to the pub.
So with this turn in the 90s towards a new form of consumption, with the reintegration of rave and the way that, you know, working class people are forced back into pubs, especially young people, they're not forced back into pubs that are the same as the ones they were forced out of, right? There's been a transition whereby there's a new kind of consumption enabled, where, for instance, you're really thinking about different audiences occupying different niches in a much more differentiated way. So whereas historically, particularly if we go all the way back to kind of the Manchester example, pubs were primarily defined by location, where there wouldn't be that much intervariation in like the particular form of commodity experience sold by a pub. But with increased attention to the pub as a productive workplace rather than just an outlet to sell beer, it becomes a much more produced environment, and part of that production is like specializing for certain kinds of customers. So, you know, you could think about the way in which a craft ale pub particularly caters to someone who likes, you know, IPAs with a huge amount of hop, because that conveys a certain kind of identity for them. Or you can think about the way in which, you know, Wetherspoons is this kind of attempt to appeal universally, but does bend in terms of age towards the young who can afford it and the old who feel it as kind of comfortable. There is a really interesting process whereby the pub goes from being a not universal, certainly people have always been excluded from pubs along lines of gender, race and so on and so forth, or cultural identity in certain ways, but you get this marketplace of identities where you have a certain niche in the nighttime economy in a way that maybe historically you wouldn't have done. And from there, you know, that's kind of how we get today to the dominance of these centrally managed pub companies, you know, the big ones like Wetherspoons, also, you know, Green King, a load of others, and how we get the modern pub environment as the inheritor of binge culture. Only now, obviously, binge drinking isn't quite what it used to be, and you don't have this kind of the externality, you don't have the rave that has to be fought off. So you experience, I think, kind of a stagnation in the cultural identity of pubs, where because there's no longer this demand that like innovation is stimulated in order to outcompete the external threat of rave culture, you get a deterioration in what's being offered to people in terms of the pub as a site of recreation. Which isn't to say that, you know, there's no positive identification with the pub, which isn't to say that people don't enjoy going to the pub, but just to say that, you know, now that that process of what late Mark Fisher would have called consciousness deflation has been achieved, maybe, you know, the role of the pub is going to change in the years ahead. And certainly as we all go back into these places and start doing collective socializing after what must be like a historic break in the opportunity to hang out, it's going to be an interesting development.
Cheers to Callum Cant for that history. Callum's book, Riding for Delivery, Resistance in the New Economy, is out now.
Hi, I'm George Briley. I'm a PhD student at the OU, a TWT organiser, and a former bartender on and off for about the past 10 years. So when we're thinking about pubs, I think it's important to start, obviously, with COVID-19 and the pandemic, is remembering that the industry has been under government restriction for, you know, a whole year now. Pub companies are reporting massive losses, kind of unsurprisingly, and figures suggest that around 600,000 people in hospitality were on furlough in December. So while I give you some statistics next, it's worth remembering that a lot of this will change when we see the industry come out of defreeze later this month. But in 2018, we had about 450,000 people employed in the pub industry. That's a 21% increase from 2001. But we do see a net decrease of employees in the north. Alongside this, around 11,000 pubs closed since 2008. But between 2008 and 2018, $2 billion has been added in revenue to the industry. Alongside this, 72% of staff hired part-time, roughly, And between 2001 and 2018, we see an increase in the size of pubs. So pubs that employ 25 to 49 staff have increased by 75%. And pubs that employ 50 plus members of staff have increased by about 25%. So what we're learning from this is that there's less bars, there's bigger bars, and there's more staff in one place, and there's more revenue in the sector. So clearly there's some quite interesting things happening here. But those statistics don't really give us a picture of what it's actually like to work in a pub or to organise in a pub. So that's why we're talking to Liz, who is a bartender and organiser in South London. Hi, Liz.
Hello.
So thanks for coming to talk to us. Maybe we could begin by just starting with the question, why did you begin organising in your workplace?
Well, I worked in pubs for about, I got made redundant in November 2020, but until then I've been working in pubs for about 8 years. And from my very first pub job, it had been not great conditions, you know, serious health and safety breaches, you know, rubbish hours, terrible pay. Especially from my first job, knowing what I know now after organising and getting involved with union work, like I couldn't, you know, it's shocking what employers get away with. And so when I got approached by some union activists that came into my pub and asked if I'd be interested, I leapt on it because I wasn't even aware that that was a thing that you could do within pubs. Like it was something that was worthwhile. Because in other sectors, you know, there is more of a union presence, and you know, things like company sick pay, you know, provisions for sick pay, provisions for bereavement, fixed hours, even, you know, they're not mad notions, but within hospitality they are. So that's why I wanted to get involved and start organising.
Yeah, and you kind of led into this as well, right? Because you worked for a pub co. in South London, which is, as we've heard earlier in the programme, a form of pub chain, pub retailing chain, and you were organising across those chains, right?
Yeah, the one that I worked for, it was quite, it had a bit of a unique selling point of giving the illusion of independence, you know, like that each pub was its independent little unit. Not a chain. They had, you know, they had, like, each manager had autonomy over their own site. And that's not true. and you know, they're very rooted in the community. So they said, you know, their branding was all about them being, like, you know, the Great British Pub. Like, oh, you know, it's part of the community and it's such a vital resource for people. But it wasn't a vital resource for workers or bringing money into the local economy by providing jobs, which is what they said. So it was tricky because they were kind of like in the middle of like a massive chain and then a complete independent, but they had this illusion of it. You know, they referred to themselves as a collective rather than a company.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, what kind of lessons do you think you learned from that experience organising across that chain and in your workplace? And yeah, how have you applied those lessons elsewhere?
One major lesson was, I guess, like, I kind of knew it myself because I started organising, like, about six years of working in pubs. The fact that I hadn't thought of it or, you know, even seen any organising within pubs, it kind of... And then when I started trying to organise, like, realising that none of my colleagues anywhere really had even heard of a union or workers' rights or didn't, you know, hadn't even read their contract properly, anything. So the lack of a sense of empowerment within bar workers' jobs is just kind of at a zero. And I think, you know, you see a lot of people, you know, when they first get hired, if they're too problematic, will easily be gotten rid of. So I think the lesson I'm taking away from it is that we've got to sort of start from scratch, completely start from scratch. You know, it's education about what a job even is to you. you know, like how your life revolves around work and how work should revolve around your life. So what I've sort of gone to now is I got involved with a group called SLBN, which is South London Bartenders Network. And that was kind of set up to bridge the gap between workers, the community, and a union in order to just get better conditions for workers across the board. You know, so it's not just working, you know, working and organizing to get better pay. I mean, obviously better pay will make you happier, especially when it's such dire pay right now. But just across like the whole board, you know, issues of mental health within the industry and with, you know, within your customer base, within your colleagues, issues of sexual harassment, things like that. This SLBN has a broad approach to organizing. It's not just join yourself a union, run a campaign and get going. It's about actually trying to connect bartenders to each other and figure out more creative ways to organize, I guess.
That's great, yeah. So maybe you can just give us a bit more info on the kind of stuff that the South London bartenders are focusing on. You know, you've talked about it there a bit, the mental health, but what do you think the big issues are facing pub workers at the moment, and how can a kind of network structure work alongside a union structure to address those, do you think?
Well, I think what SLBN are doing a lot of now, just to sort of get started, is events, like sort of socialising events. And it's funny because as hospitality workers, your main job role is to provide a space for socialising. You know, that's how you work, and pub workers are good at doing that for themselves within little units, potentially within their own little clusters. But when it comes to organising, it doesn't happen. So the events is a big part of providing the social space that is also an active space for workers to talk about their issues. There isn't such a formalised union.
Great, yeah. So I guess my last question, when I know this is going to be quite a speculative one, was just like to hear your thoughts. Where do you think bar worker, pub worker organising can go in this country, in South London? What do you think the possibilities are for more bar workers to get together, to get organised, and to win, you know, the conditions and the kind of respect that you talk about when you're talking about the issues? What do you think the potential is there for bartenders to get more gains?
I've got really grandiose schemes, like hopes and dreams for bartending organising. Just because, I mean, especially after the lockdown, you know, I mean, you can see that people are just absolutely desperate for pubs and restaurants, like desperate for that social space. You know, you're looking at like the history of organising, like how pivotal like pubs and those kind of spaces have been in providing like the glue for those organisations and those movements. And so I think to get bartenders active, to get that job given more sort of social clout, like given more importance in society and then, you know, what it provides. It could, if bartenders are organised and really thoughtful about it, they could be such a good conduit for further organising and more solidarity across sectors. You know, I have this proper fantasy of like, you know, no one gets a pint until the NHS is sorted out. You know, no one gets a pint until the nurse can have a sit down and have one with you. That kind of idea of, you know, more creative ways of protesting or striking, you know, or slowing down. That's the pub is in, like, or restaurant, things like that. They're in such a unique position within society where the workers have such a direct social interaction and contact and influence over the general public or their local communities. And I think it's usefully positioned because with the Tories, especially with like Tories under Boris Johnson, there's this real jingoistic nonsense that he keeps putting out about, you know, pride in Britain and stuff like that, and the pub, you know, Nigel Farage led all his campaigns from the pub. He's like, why are the right wing taking over that narrative? They don't know anything about their local communities. They don't know anything about what it takes to work in a service industry, what it takes to work in a low-paid job, stuff like that. So I think if we could get it, so if we could get bar workers organised, you know, it would be a catalyst for other organising, you know, and it would demonstrate that these apparently unorganisable spaces can be organised. We've just got to be creative about it.
Thanks to TWT organiser George Briley and Liz from the South London Bartenders Network for letting us listen into that conversation. To end, we want to take you on a pub crawl like no other. We're travelling across the country and through the last century to visit some pubs with a particular importance to us on the left.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way.
For the first stop on our pub crawl, we're heading north to Cumbria and the Scottish borders. Online, we often hear tongue-in-cheek calls to nationalise Wetherspoons. The Carlisle experiment was the First World War iteration of just that, state-owned and operated breweries and pubs. But it was enacted not for ease of comradely boozing, but with stricter intentions.
We arrive at the Gretna Tavern in Carlisle, a large and slightly imposing former post office building. The Carlisle experiment began in 1916 to prevent drunkenness among munitions factory workers who lived nearby. By 1915, the authorities were deeply concerned that excessive drinking among the workforce was taking its toll on productivity and threatening Britain's war effort.
In March of that year, Minister of Munitions David Lloyd George went as far as to declare, "We are fighting Germany, Austria and drink. And as far as I can see, the greatest of these deadly foes is drink."
Workers were well paid and had nowhere to spend their money except in the pubs, leading to poor productivity and absenteeism. To combat this, the state set about nationalising all the breweries and over 300 pubs and licensed premises in Carlisle, Gretna, Silloth and a large part of rural North Cumbria, as well as in a small part of Scotland close to the border.
We enter the Gretna Tavern and are met with a large and spacious room. The nationalised pubs knock through the usual partitions of multiple small bars to create big, easy-to-supervise spaces. There is good seating and tables have been installed to reduce vertical drinking and to encourage women to visit, while diluting and disarming more boisterous and obnoxious male behaviour. There is also food, entertainment and games such as darts, dominoes, snooker and bowls.
We make our way to the bar and order a dark and mild. The man behind the bar isn't a typical landlord, but something closer to a civil servant, paid in a flat salary with no incentive to sell more. As you take a sip, you're sure to be disappointed. The beer has cost you the going rate, but it is intentionally weak. When we think of nationalised pubs, this isn't quite what we had in mind. Time for us to move on in search of stronger stuff.
The year was 1965 and we're in Smethwick in the West Midlands. The area is highly charged with racial tension between white and Indian workers. In the previous year, the constituency was won from Labour by the Tory MP Peter Griffiths, who ran on a slogan using an explicit racial slur we won't repeat here.
We are standing outside the Blue Gates pub, where we are greeted by two doors. There's a colour bar. Hearing a rousing speech, we push through the carved wooden saloon door of the Indian entrance. Inside, incredibly, we find black revolutionary Malcolm X sipping half a bitter. Malcolm, who was invited to the area by Avtar Singh Jewell from the Indian Workers Association, who wanted to make Malcolm aware of the segregation Indian workers were suffering in the area. He himself experienced that racism, having tried to enter the whites' entrance only to be refused service.
Malcolm's trip was credited with helping to empower the local Indian community, and a relaxing of racial tensions gradually took place, with many Indian business people buying up ailing or disused pubs throughout the 70s to create the Desi pub, traditional English pub architecture and ales with Punjabi food and banger on the jukebox. In the nearby Red Lion, one such Desi pub, Malcolm X's visit is commemorated in a stained glass window set into the door. He was assassinated just 9 days later, giving a speech in New York.
Our pub crawl has continued its journey south through the country to the capital. It's the early hours of a cold November evening and we're on the dance floor of the Joiners Arms in East London. The music is heavy and pumping, the atmosphere is grungy, and you've got a pint of lager in your hand. We're in one of London's best queer pubs and the atmosphere is amazing.
In late 2014, the Friends of Joiners Arms was formed in response to the threatened closure of the pub by developers who planned to demolish the premises and replace them with a new luxury housing development. The pub closed the next year in 2015. However, the Friends of Joiners Arms campaign continued, fighting for the inclusion of a late licensed queer venue on the site of the Joiners Arms as part of this new development.
After a long, hard battle, in late 2017, the Tower Hamlets Council granted permission to develop the site, as long as the following conditions were met. A pub must be included in the new development, which should be run as an LGBTQI+ venue with a lease of 25 years, and with opening hours mirroring those of the original pub. Furthermore, the developers should pay for the first year's rent and contribute to the fit-out costs of the new venue.
Like the famous Royal Vauxhall Tavern just south of the Thames, which was the first building in Britain to win listed status for its role in LGBTQ+ history and heritage, the campaign for the Joiners Arms forms part of a long line of pubs that have played a crucial role within the queer community. As Dan Laverick, a member of the Friends of Joiners Arms, says, "It's always worth fighting for the things that are important to you and your community. We have always known that this is part of a much wider struggle over who controls urban space, and have always taken the view that our changing urban landscape should be decided by the people who live, work and socialise in our cities."
So as soon as this pub closes, as soon as this pub closes, as soon as this pub closes, the revolution starts.
Our final destination is the moon underwater. But this pub is unlike any other on our crawl. It exists not in the material world, but in the mind of George Orwell. In 1943, Orwell wrote The Pub and the People in response to Mass Observation's review of pub usage in Bolton. His essay was a mental exercise in imagining his own perfect pub. The moon under the water is just 2 minutes from a bus stop. Inside, the middle-aged barmaids don't call him Ducky, and you could eat a filling lunch but not dinner. It is full of the hazy nostalgia and faint whiff of reaction that we might expect from Orwell.
But as we sit, nursing one for the road in the annals of Orwell's imagination, a lively discussion ensues. What would our own imagined moon underwater be like? Or are we, like Orwell, in danger of romanticising the pub? Of course they're businesses, but pubs can be more than a place to get pissed. If our crawl has taught us anything, it's that they can be important spaces for solidarity and togetherness, particularly for different communities throughout history. The pub is at its best when it facilitates the use of public space that is purposefully not productive, that is leisurely, that is familial. It's telling that, for most people, their favourite pub is one in which they hold special relationships, with the bar staff and with the customers.
There is, however, one advantage to an imaginary pub, one which Orwell does not cover in his essay. That is, a pub of the mind can never be visited by politicians on the campaign trail looking for a photo op.
"That man is not allowed in my pub. Get out of my pub. Go on. Get out of my pub."
We're grateful to Autonomy for their support in making this series. To find out about their planning for the future of work and hence what our leisure time will look like, head to autonomy.work. TWT is committed to providing radical political education to build a world transformed, but we need your help. So please subscribe to this podcast, tell your friends, and consider becoming a supporter of the organisation by visiting theworldtransformed.org. Together, we can imagine, demand, and build a world transformed.